These aren't new plans, districtly speaking.
A new draft district policy has been released as former city manager Andre Korbold has been undrafted from the payroll.
Plus, Edmonton has accumulated an additional 100,000 people in the past 2 years, and some are questioning if we can handle it.
Hi, I'm Troy.
I'm Mac.
And we're
Speaking Municipally.
Welcome back to Speaking Municipally, the big 260, and I am back, but I wasn't here last week for the first time in Speaking Municipally history.
We survived. We got an episode out the door, but we're also very glad to have you back, Troy. Welcome back.
And I endeavor to never leave again. You know, I will say the editors you got did a great job. The podcast sounded great, but I understand people who, you know, produce a TV show and then new showrunners get hired, why they can't watch the TV show.
Yeah.
I could just hear little pieces where I'm like, I would have done that differently. And it's very difficult having released all the control on a thing that you previously had full control over.
It's like people who can't stand listening to the sound of their own voice even, right? It could be just as simple as that.
Yeah, and I too hated that. But after 260 episodes of forcing myself to listen to it every week, you get over it.
Shout out to Castria, who helped us edit last week's episode while Troy was away.
Yeah, there was a part I was actually a little bit frustrated with because, you know, you could hear you and Stephanie and you record in Unit B and there's a bit of like fan noise in the back and I usually filter it out pretty good. I did notice they did it a little bit better than me. And so like right off the top, I was like a little bit frustrated. I'm like, oh, they amped up your voice just a little bit better than I normally do.
Well, it is what they do. So, you know, you would expect they're good at their jobs. And we love working with Castria. We've worked with them on several other podcasts in the past. So,
though, just because someone is in a job doesn't mean they're good at it. See Andre Korbold, who is no longer in a job. I think we can make that joke now. We found out where the former city manager Andre Korbold has landed. And landed quite quickly, I'll add. His last day at the city was only April 3rd or 4th. And there was a release this week that he has joined Danchilla Consulting or Integrated Strategic Partnerships, depending on which release you looked at.
Interestingly, you know, they mentioned that he's the former city manager of Edmonton in this news release, but they say his experience includes leading the emergency management and recovery of the 2013 Calgary floods, security for the 2010 Olympics, and deputy commanding general of a U.S. Army and NATO division of 25,000 in Afghanistan. Really interesting that they foreground all of that and none of the things that he seemed to do in Edmonton or maybe didn't do while he was city manager here in Edmonton.
This is all done within the backdrop of, was Andre Korbold fired? We had talked about recently, you know, the acrimony that city council has had with Andre Korbold in the past. And I opined that it was because of his close ties to the UCP to the point where he was undermining council. So I thought it was interesting when he joined this new Integrated Strategic Partnerships, which is, you know, a partnership between Danchilla Consulting and Think HQ and Zag Creative in Edmonton. And looking at the partners involved, I mean, Hal Danchilla has been credited with being a trusted advisor and campaign strategist for Jason Kenney. In 2021, he was top five individual UCP donors. And, you know, Mark Henry, who runs Think HQ, if you look at that Twitter feed, it is exclusively Rick Bell, Calgary Sun retweets. I don't know that Andre Korbold has put a lot of distance between himself and the UCP with this new position.
No, it seems cozy, actually. The other organization I think that's involved in this ISP that you didn't mention is P3 Capital, which, of course, is a P3 company, something he would have had some experience with at the city of Edmonton.
And that P3 Capital is headed up by former PC MLAs Doug Horner and Jeff Johnston, who, you know, had ministerial positions back. I believe Jeff Johnston was actually one of Alison Redford's ministers. So, you know, there's a deep level of conservative brass that has been involved in this new organization. I don't know. I'm feeling a little bit of vindication with this new hire.
Indeed, as you should. Well, congratulations, Andre Korbold, on the new role. We were worried about you, but it seems we didn't need to be. It was a very quick turnaround, as you say, Troy. Just 2 weeks.
Of course, the work at the city ticks on, and the big piece of work that's coming up is district planning. This can be thought of as part two of the zoning bylaw renewal process. You'll recall back last year, there was a lot of public hearings about the new zoning bylaw renewal, which eventually got approved. But one of the big points of criticism that opponents had for the ZBR was that it should be done in tandem with district planning. That's the process underway, and that's essentially to establish a bunch of districts around the city and what the city wants each of those districts to look like. Councillor Ann Stevenson talked about the zoning bylaw renewal, basically giving the tools, the paints and the brushes, and then the district planning is actually making the painting, using the tools provided to accomplish the goals of the city plan. And we have a draft policy and some draft districts.
That's right. We now have this draft district policy. It's a 51-page document that's going to be going to public hearing here in the spring. And there's 15 districts that go alongside this district policy. The city plan kind of underlines everything. District plans is like the next level. And actually in the document, the city has a visualization with this where they've got the city plan, district plans. Then you have area structure and redevelopment plans, neighborhood structure plans, and then the zoning bylaw, which is the smallest bit at the top. And so it kind of outlines how these things fit together. But the district plans and the district policy are statutory plans. That's why they're coming to public hearing, of course. And the only document, my understanding is, that overrides the district plans is, of course, city plan itself, which is our municipal development plan. But as you say, there's a policy, there's 15 districts. The idea is to inform and guide decision-making that has to happen around rezoning applications or development permit applications, especially where there's a situation where there's discretionary development, perhaps changes needed to the zoning bylaw, that the district plans are meant to guide that.
I don't know if you've had a wild, raucous night this week, but there's a 51-page district plan policy that's been put out in draft. There's also, like you said, 15 districts themselves, all of which have plans which are in the realm of 40 to 60 pages each. So, you know, there's thousands of pages to read, and I have not yet read them all, Mac.
I've not read them all yet either. I've scanned through a little bit of it, and I've looked at this helpful document that the city did put out. So if you were paying attention to district policies and plans, they have an overview of changes in 2024. So it's just the things that they've changed, you know, since the last version of this that we got to look at. So that could be helpful. If you are kind of coming into this for the first time, which is understandable, you might have a little bit more reading to do than that.
Taking a skim in some of the plans and policies, I think none of this is really surprising, right? The district plans, like you said, are the next level above the city plan. And, you know, we're all quite intimately familiar with the city plan. We always knew district plans were going to look something like this. But I think what shocked me in looking at some of this district planning policy and some of the district plans is, given the level of ambition that we had with city plan and the zoning bylaw renewal, you know, strong towns and other organizations had given us credits for ambitious planning. Honestly, it struck me that the district plans weren't incredibly ambitious. You talked about this a little bit briefly with Stephanie last week in terms of transit-oriented development and how, you know, there's not actually a whole lot of intense densification planned for the areas around our transit lines. And I kind of see that
right
all across the city with our district plans. I think the most glaring spot that I noticed is I looked at the SCONA plan, which is my home district. There's a red area of like densification, higher levels of build, and it cuts off right on the West Road at the side of the University of Alberta, which goes over to Windsor Park. You have the University of Alberta, one of the biggest campuses in Western Canada. It's hugely dense. It's very walkable. You know, you can't drive through campus, and you have thousands of students who come here every year to study at the University of Alberta. And yet the neighborhood directly beside, bordering literally stone's throw away from campus, does not have high levels of density planned in district plan. That strikes me as, while we had bold ambitions, the actual mechanics of what we've produced is full of compromise, and exactly the compromises you'd expect.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting. We didn't really touch on it quite as much last week, but, you know, another reason perhaps we don't have the density around transit stations that we were expecting is those old guidelines from 2012, the transit-oriented development guidelines, they're being retired. They're being replaced by district planning. And this shift away from TOD towards what they call nodes and corridors, right, in the district planning parlance, is maybe part of that. In making that shift, I think there's a lot of trade-offs that have to be made. And it's not as obvious as, you know, around a transit center, we're going to really increase the density. And maybe we need some of that still in these district plans. Well, one other thing I wanted to mention about the district planning is, alongside these new districts, they're also doing what we saw with zoning bylaw renewal, which is getting rid of a whole bunch of other plans. And I think that's really interesting, actually. So they have this list of all of the different districts, and within each district, all of the plans that will either be repealed or changed or kept. And you can look through this document. Unfortunately, I couldn't find a number off the top for how many there are, but there's a significant number that are being repealed. And so this means they're out of date or they don't reflect, you know, modern planning. And I think it's a really good exercise to simplify the number of statutory documents we have that help us make these kinds of decisions. The more we have, the more chance there is for ambiguity and that kind of thing. Thinking about just at Taproot, we talk about this all the time. The more words you put out, the more places you potentially have to fix or edit something. So fewer words means less chance of ambiguity. So I think that's another, you know, beneficial part of this exercise probably is to make sure all of our statutory plans are up to date and there's fewer of them and it's clearer to know where to go when you're looking for information about how to make a decision.
This exercise reminded me a little bit of the parking changes that the city has made just a couple of weeks ago, which was to, you know, decommission resident parking in 15 neighborhoods across the city, which Councillor Ashley Salvador said basically was established ad hoc over the course of several years. It's like a neighborhood wanted it and city council was like, yeah, sure, without really being clear about why those things were being added. And when you look at area structure plans and neighborhood structure plans, a lot of them do feel like that. You know, they look at a particular area and say, this is what we want this area to look like without looking at that area in the context of the entire city, which was what city plan and district planning has been doing. I know people in perhaps McKernan and Belgravia who are going to eventually get their neighborhood and area structure plans repealed in favor of these district planning may not be huge fans of this.
You're right. McKernan, Belgravia Station ARP, Strathcona ARP, Strathcona Junction ARP, all of these old documents are going to be repealed in favor of the SCONA district plan, one of the districts. Well, we should mention that the city is hosting 3 virtual public information sessions about the district policy and all 15 district plans. That's coming up on April 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. So you can sign up for those. And then this will, like we've mentioned off the top, go to public hearing at City Council from May 28th to May 30th.
Of course, all of this is, like we said, in service of embodying the city plan. And a microcosm of embodying the city plan has been a Blatchford. I'd call it City Council's test bed of, can we do a neighborhood in a way that is sustainable, that is community focused, that is green and walkable? And, you know, depending on who you ask, the answer might be no, we can't. We got an update about an audit on Blatchford, and Mac, things aren't looking great, I think is the summary.
I think that's a fair summary. It's maybe that things haven't changed much since the last time we talked about Blatchford. So the new numbers we have is that 84 homes are now occupied in Blatchford. 2.5 years ago, there was just 20. An earlier report that administration had brought forth, you'll recall, had said that things were progressing basically as well as they could for development of this nature. This new audit report calls a little bit of that into question. The goal, of course, of Blatchford is to have 30,000 people living there by 2042 and to be 100% carbon neutral when it actually gets there. So it doesn't feel like we're on track to that, but the number of things under construction and the number of units built is about 156, and another 163 are expected to be constructed on lots that have already been sold. So there is progress here. It's just perhaps not as quick as we would all have liked to see, and certainly as Councillor Tim Carmel has been talking about. The audit, of course, wasn't just to say, where are we? The purpose of the audit was to say, do we know where we are to some degree? And it found that the city hasn't been effectively tracking its progress on Blatchford. And so that's an area for improvement.
I do think it's important to track your data. I do think it's important to, you know, make sure you're analyzing your success towards your goals. I did think that the reporting around this audit was pretty stupid overall. There are 80 homes occupied in Blatchford, up from 20 2.5 years ago. If you want to audit your progress on Blatchford, head on over there and glance at it.
Yeah.
Great. You've completed your audit. Accurately tracking metrics like this is certainly important when you have a whole neighborhood built out. But when a dude saying, nah, looks good, is sufficient audit progress, I don't think that we actually need 3 layers of bureaucracy and 4 interim managers to manage this project. In fact, I think that would be the exact middle management that the city has been criticized and told to avoid.
Yeah, it certainly seems like a little bit of red tape, perhaps. But, you know, I can understand the point of view of the auditor that you need to have good systems in place in order for ongoing progress to be tracked, right? So it might only be 80 homes now and somebody can go and take a look. But at some point there will be more progress and there'll be bigger. There'll be lots more homes, 30,000 people. You want to kind of get those systems in place now, right? The other part about Blatchford, of course, is that it's a key climate initiative, right? The whole idea of building Blatchford and making it a fully renewable powered community is to help us reach our climate goals. And there was also an audit report on the city's climate strategies. And unsurprisingly to me, Troy, that audit found gaps in the governance structure of the city's climate goals.
Are you sure the goals that we're going to have the carbon budget itemized on every single report that's sent to City Council, which has, to my knowledge, almost never been done, there's gaps in that process?
Yeah, I mean, there are gaps, and the city has said they are going to start implementing the auditor's recommendations, but it's going to take from now till 2026 to do that. So if you read the audit, there's quite a bit of work that they need to do in order to meet what you would expect is sort of like the bare minimum here if this is important to us.
But 2026, the world will only be what, like a degree Celsius warmer by then? No rush.
One of the things you will see, Troy, although I don't know exactly when, an environment and climate review section will be added to all standard council reports. Finally, that's what they're going to call it.
Yeah, of course, the undercurrent in all of this Blatchford discussion, why has this come up? Partially because of the audit, but the other part is, as you and Stephanie talked about last week, there's an 8.7 property tax increase glaring down the gullet of our current city council. Councillors like former councillor Michael Walters and Tim Cartmell will say things like, Blatchford is a piggy bank that we can raid. You know, if we change to single family zoning in Blatchford, this stuff will sell like hotcakes, right? We can quickly liquidate all this land if we give up on city being developers in Blatchford and let the private industry develop it in any way they want. You can get quite a bit of immediate money right into the city's coffers, of course, eschewing the long-term sustainability that we wanted for the Blatchford community. I hope our city council remains steadfast, but you know, if you've got a budget crisis and a piggy bank staring you right down where the old city center airport used to be, it can be tempting to raid that to lower that number.
So we didn't get to talk to you last week about it. What's your take? Do you think we'll end up lower than 8.7?
Yep.
Do you think council will find some savings? Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I had talked a little bit on Twitter about this too. People are starting to opine that every time there's a budget update, we get this number in the media about tax increase is going to be so high and it's the administration proposal and then council negotiates it down and then it gets less. And in previous budgets with Corbald at the helm, you and I had talked about how, is this sabotage by administration,
right?
You know, trying to make it seem worse. The thing that I have noticed, though, is we've been covering this for a long time now. You've been covering it even longer. And this has always happened. It's not new to city councilors. So if city councilors didn't see political expediency to this process, they probably would have made moves to do something different along the way. I have to assume that city councilors like the story of how they were able to claw back and be fiscally prudent, even while raising people's taxes. So for that reason alone, I'm certain we're going to get a lowering of this property tax increase.
I think you're right. I think there's certainly a political expediency that comes with that. You know, being the good guys and gals that got to lower the proposed cut. It's just, if you stop and think about it, they're your employee. You should give them good direction. You've made noise about priority-based budgeting and all kinds of things. Yeah, it doesn't actually come that way in the end.
Of course, all of this, too, is like OP12. Where is OP12 going to land now that the city manager, chiefly in charge of it, has departed? We don't know. Perhaps council will have to self-do OP12 by looking at the proposed budget and, you know, reallocating certain items to priority areas. That might be something we see at the spring operating budget adjustment. While this may be a contentious adjustment because of the numbers involved, you and I both know most spring budget adjustments are usually quite calm and quite quick for approvals. I don't expect a large belabored budget debate that goes on for several weeks.
Well, and I was going to say, I think it could be worse, Troy. I don't know if you saw the news this week, but down in Calgary, where you'll recall they had quite a large tax increase. They finished fiscal 2023 with a $238 million budget surplus. So people are understandably upset in Calgary about this huge surplus when they significantly increased taxes, larger than Edmonton did at the time. And, you know, I just can imagine how that would go over if that was here. And that, of course, follows a 2022 budget surplus of almost $260 million. So the conversation down in Calgary from counselors is very different than the one here. Instead of setting them up to make those cuts and look very successful, there they're like, you are our employee. How are you so bad at budgeting?
I don't think our Edmonton City Council is at any risk of having a substantial surplus this year. So crisis averted there. We do have another crisis brewing, though, with 100,000 people coming to the city in the past 2 years. An entire Red Deer has moved up here. A couple councillors have indicated, hey, if this trend continues, I don't know if we're quite ready for it.
Yeah, I mean, we are obviously working on this plan to grow to 2 million people. We want to double the size of Edmonton. That's what City Plan posits, right? We think this is happening. Our projections show that this is happening. But perhaps our growth is happening already a little faster than was anticipated. So 100,000 people in 2 years is quite a large number. That was Andrew Knack's quote. A Red Deer has moved into Edmonton in the last 2 years. And CBC did the story about whether or not we're ready. They also were talking about Alberta's population boom as well, because the province itself has been growing quite significantly, maybe because of all those ads they're running, Troy.
And Alberta other is calling, Mac.
Yeah, absolutely. In Edmonton, of course, the question is, as a municipality, are we ready to support this number of people? And Councillor Knack says, you know, we need roads, we need utility lines, we need police stations, fire halls, rec centers, libraries, etc. We know how long things take to plan and come to fruition. How long did Andrew Knack lead the charge on the Lewis Farms Recreation Center, for example? Like, things don't happen as quickly as the number of people are coming into our city. So I think that's an interesting challenge. And the way that we pay for those things, if it's not taxpayers and municipal taxes, it's other orders of government. And with the province, as we talked about previously, maybe not providing as much funding to the city of Edmonton as it once did, it just adds pressure on that need to fund the maintenance and development of infrastructure.
And of course, many people coming to Edmonton, you know, might be coming for our, you know, Valley Line LRT and some of our new infrastructure. But I think if you were to look at the demographics of the people moving to Edmonton, it's people who have seen the ads, seen the stories, and Edmonton is the most affordable city to move into, depending on what metric you are using. When they talk about affordability, they're talking about affordability of single family homes in typical new suburb areas, right? A lot of the people that are moving into Edmonton are chasing this dream of living in a Spruce Grove or a St. Albert or the communities that look like that, which are located conveniently outside the Henday. It's driving up demand for exactly the type of city that City Plan doesn't endeavor to build. And I think that friction is another point of intense contention, right? While we have condo markets cratering and owners being underwater on their condo purchases, we also have a booming single family home market with zero lot lines down in the deep south of Edmonton. That friction is going to be problematic, I think, for City Council, because, you know, 100,000 people moving into Edmonton in 2 years, that can swing a vote, right? If those people all vote in the same way, if those people are all coming to Edmonton wanting cheap single family homes, and Edmonton City Council says no more single family homes, and you don't have bus service or rec centers down in the deep south, why don't you move into the core? You know, there may be some friction in electoral politics that happens right there. And that's something that I think councillors should be aware of.
Bit of personal commentary here from me, Troy, on this. I think when people are looking at Edmonton, they're thinking, I can actually afford to buy a home there. Possible to become a homeowner in Edmonton, whereas I'm priced out of the market in these other places. If you actually come and you look at the prices, you'll see what you point out, which is that condos are a lot cheaper than single family homes, right? And you can afford to buy a condo in Edmonton a lot more easily than you can buy a single family home. I feel like our biggest gap here is that all of our condos are too small. There's not enough bedrooms. There's not enough. If you're a family and you're moving to Edmonton, can you choose to live in a condo? I mean, I know some people have, but it's a harder decision to make. There's not as much space. We don't build the kinds of condos that are conducive to a small and growing family, right? And if we had more of that kind of housing stock available, it might alleviate some of the pressure both on those condo owners who you described who are struggling, but also the cost of single family homes. There was an op-ed published just today from Kaylin Anderson and Susan Keating, who are both the CEO and the chair, respectively, of UDI Edmonton. And they talk a lot about, you know, what we need to do in 2024 to try to build a better Edmonton is their headline. But it's really all about housing for the most part. And they have this section about address the housing crisis by bolstering affordability, and some information in there about for every $10,000 added to the cost of an entry-level home, you know, this number of people are priced out of the housing market. And it just struck me when I was reading that, that city council itself has not a great deal of impact on that number, right? You know, there's only so much that the municipal officials and decisions can do to really impact that number, at least in the kind of time scales that we're talking about.
Though, you know, one thing that can really impact that number is transportation planning, right? If you are able to move from a two-car household to a one-car household, the amount of house you can increase substantially increases. And that's a lever that our city council can absolutely pull and is pulling with these district plans. If you can build a city where transportation is easier, housing costs become much more affordable because you have more money available to provide for housing. We had talked previously that former CEO Catherine Warren no longer has a home at Edmonton Unlimited. We now know who the new hire will be.
Edmonton Unlimited has hired Tom Vinica, who's the current CEO of the Edmonton Screen Industries Office. So it's another one of those Edmonton organizations that does an international global search and then find somebody close to home to hire into the role. I think it's fine, actually. I think Tom is a pretty interesting choice for this. He's been, I think, widely respected in his role at the ESIO. He's a startup founder himself. He co-founded VR Cave and Align VR, and was a part of another group called Omen Capital before he joined the Screen Industries Office. So he's got some, I think, relevant and interesting experience that he'll bring to this. And of course, because he's been a member of this creative innovation ecosystem through the Screen Industries Office, he knows a lot of the players. He's built some good relationships, and I think should be able to hit the ground running at Edmonton Unlimited in a way that an outsider wouldn't be able to. And you know, I'm sure the board was considering a lot of things when they made their selection, but one of those might have been, I wonder what our funder would say about this choice. And if your previous choice was somebody from outside the city who came in and that didn't work out, you might be gun-shy about trying to find somebody from outside the city and bring them in again, right? And so maybe a safer choice to go with somebody who kind of knows the space and the players. So he starts on May 15th, and Lana Asbeslet, who was the interim, will resume her role on the board of Edmonton Unlimited. So be exciting to see where this goes.
And for the listener who is thinking, Edmonton Unlimited, what exactly does that do again? That is the entrepreneurship organization, you know, that replaced sort of Startup Edmonton and the EEDC and chose a really self-explanatory great name that just in conversation lets you know what the organization is all about.
I should recall that not everyone knows the organizations and acronyms we're talking about. Edmonton Unlimited runs a lot of the accelerator programs and things like that here in Edmonton as well. So if you have an idea, you want to start a business, you want to get some help figuring out how to do that, Edmonton Unlimited is one of the places you might go to do that.
And they do have a physical space downtown that you can go to meet with and engage in some of that ideas. And kitty corner to that space downtown is Rice Howard Way, which is now slated to potentially become a entertainment district at nighttime. This is a proposal that the city, you and Stephanie had talked about this a little bit last week in terms of having a nightmare or nightmare, mm-hmm. as it might be. And the city is now collecting feedback on exactly what this entertainment district might look like and how it'll take place. I gotta say, this is something we had heard inklings about when we talked with Stephen and Jason of Paths for People and UDI back in a previous episode. And, you know, they had indicated that some great things were coming for Rice Howard Way, and that we need not worry about our pedestrianization. We need not be so cynical because some great things are coming to Rice Howard Way later on in the season. And Mac, I hope it wasn't this, because, you know, I'm not super impressed.
Yeah, this public engagement has just wrapped up on this on April 16th. They had this online survey they were running. And if you went to Engaged Edmonton, their website, you could see a little map of the area that they're talking about turning into an entertainment district. And you pointed out to me, Troy, on this map, there's a yellow box, which is where the district would be, and there's green arrows, which is where traffic would be. And if I read this map correctly, those green arrows go right through the middle of the entertainment district. So we would kind of close this to cars, but in true Edmonton form, actually not really at all.
Yeah, let me paint you a picture. If you go down Rice Howard Way, you'll, you know, enter from the east side by City Hall. You'll see, you know, Sherlock's and Kraft and, you know, the seven stalls in front of Sherlock Holmes Pub. That would be closed to traffic in these nighttime events. And you'd be able to take your beers out and enjoy them out in the street. Happy-go-lucky. But once you get to that three-way stop, cars will still be driving through there. The parkades are still be open. There's still through traffic allowed there. You know, they've highlighted that the entertainment district, the yellow spot, expands over onto the west side to the already pedestrian plaza. I think when we were talking before the show, we both came to the same conclusion here that this night district, it's not about pedestrianization. It's not about urban form. This is more of... there's patios. This is a subsidy to the businesses that are there. You know, the craft market, Sherlock's, the bars in that area that want to have people drink out in public at night. And you know, I'm not saying it's a horrible thing. I do think this will bring a little bit of vibrancy to the area. I do think it's a positive change from where we are. But to call this pedestrianization, it patently is not. This is at best a super patio.
I think that's what this is geared towards, is certainly being a super patio. This would be from 11 a.m. on Friday to 11 a.m. on Sunday. So it's kind of nighttime, but also, you know, during the day, Friday and Saturday, when people are around and potentially interested in sitting out on a patio. And this would also only be in the summertime when it's nice enough to sit out on a patio. And calling it an entertainment district is really specific. That allows us to use some provincial legislation, which, as you point out, makes it possible for you to take your drink from an establishment out into this district. So you could walk around on the street with your drinks. The restaurants along there, Kraft, Sherlock's, Bianco, is that what it is, right? Bianco? The one next to Sherlock's, I can't remember the name off the top of my head. I mean, they all have sizable patios already. They've all invested quite a bit in their patios. If you've ever been to the rooftop patio at Kraft, it's quite a selling feature. Like, you go there because of the amount of effort they put into building this really nice patio. So I'm not sure I see the appeal personally of wanting to go and walk around with my drink on what is it every other time of the year, a place for cars with all of the things that come along with that. And, you know, is it, are you going to sit there? Somebody going to put out some chairs? I don't know. Like, it seems like an excuse for maybe the DBA to be able to run a concert, which they've already done on Rice Howard Way several times, or to, you know, build a little market or have a little festival there, which they've done several times. So if really this is just about reducing the cost on them to make that possible because the city decides this is a district, then I guess that's a victory. But like you, I'm not really sure I see the appeal of this from a, you know, vibrancy, pedestrianization, let's make this a livelier place point of view.
Neither of us are saying we shouldn't do this. Doing this is probably better than not doing it. The cost of doing it should be considered. But, you know, I think this is not the exciting thing that I think we both felt we were promised. I don't think it placates and sates my need for really making Edmonton an urban utopia. I don't think this is quite it. It's a bit of a miss in that regard.
I also feel a bit of vindication. When we talked with Stephen, I brought up that parkade. That's why there's through traffic here, because you need to be able to get into the parkade. That's why it's not completely closed to cars. You know, we got to do something about that parkade and Rice Hard Way if we want to actually get closer to your, you know, urban utopia, Troy, and have this thing be closed all the time and, you know, more pedestrian friendly.
Yeah, neither of the north-south roads in and around White House Howard Way are closed in any regard in this. They are still fully open to traffic as per normal.
The one thing I will say about that is that at least on the north side, it's not the most pleasant place to drive. That with the LRT and the single lane of traffic and people like me getting angry when you turn into the bike lane and, you know, that kind of stuff. There's already probably a significant decrease in the number of cars that kind of enter through there. In fact, I see more cars often using the alley between Kelly Ramsey Block and the horrible empty block of land that has rebar sticking out of it rather than going to the LRT part of it. So, you know, maybe we're overstating the fact that it remains open to traffic. But the fact is, it remains open to traffic.
If you look at the bulk of the traffic that comes on Rice Howard Way, a lot of it comes from people who want to turn left on Jasper Ave. So they make the left turn onto Rice Howard and then turn right on Jasper, which of course they won't be able to do because that left turn will be impossible during these open. Okay, maybe it's fine. Maybe it's, we will see. We'll go there. We'll enjoy a beverage on the street and we'll see. Well, Alberta's wildfire season is back up and running. We had a press conference just this morning, and what better time to talk about that than in the rapid fire segment? With over 60 fires continuing to burn from last year, Alberta's latest wildfire update has seen more than 500 hectares burned so far this year. Last year, Danielle Smith was criticized for claiming arson as the primary cause of the historic wildfire season, but she addressed that in a press conference early Thursday, saying, quote, "I Googled how do Alberta wildfires start, and the results page was 2 million matches."
The Amalgamated Transit Union Local 569 has filed a bad faith bargaining complaint against the City of Edmonton with the Alberta Labor Relations Board after the city didn't allow leadership of other unions to be present during bargaining discussions. In a response filed by the city, the position taken was, quote, "Hey, if you want us to bring on Andre as a strategic advisor..."
Not content with his parking lot win or tyranny over Boyle Street, Daryl Cates now says he plans to sue the financial struggling CKUA, claiming the community radio station did not fundraise well enough. What's worse, he says, is that CKUA didn't even give him any prime real estate to ruin.
Troy, you're getting a real boost here in rapid fire jokes. That last one came to us from Taproot reporter Colin Gallant. Thanks, Colin, for writing that one.
I leave for 1 week and already the teeth are out, ready to replace me.
No, we're glad to have you back.
Of course, Speaking Municipally is a publication of Taproot Edmonton. And of course, the Taproot Edmonton calendar continues to exist. And Mac, what's on the calendar this week?
Continue to exist, and we are working hard behind the scenes to improve it all the time. Not just with lots of new data, which there is, but also some other experience improvements. And we're getting closer and closer to more of that. But I did find a few things in the calendar that are coming up that I thought are quite interesting and I wanted to point out. So one is YEG Destination Tech. It's coming up on April 24th. It seems like there's been an increase in these kind of like, let's get all the tech people together kinds of events. And so this is at Edmonton Unlimited, which we talked about earlier, from 12:30 to 5 p.m. on April 24th. And it's meant to spotlight all of the different things that make our technology ecosystem vibrant and diverse. So I think that one could be pretty interesting. In the spirit of tech, the following day on April 25th is the next Nerd Night Edmonton. I don't know if you've ever been to one of those, Troy, but they're pretty fun events. And this one talks about machine learning, cults, and birds. I just love it.
Not only have I been to a Nerd Night, Mac, I've presented at one. I told people there...
I missed your talk.
Yeah, I told everyone there not to run for public office. And to my knowledge, no one in the audience then did.
Okay, I was thinking that was a Petra Kucha talk you did. You did that at Nerd Night.
Yeah, I like to double dip. I did both.
Okay. So I didn't miss your talk. I just missed it at Nerd Night itself. And then on May 2nd is the YEG Startup Community Awards, which are always fun. Who doesn't love winning an award? And so these are geared toward recognizing individuals and companies that are part of the startup community. And then last one I wanted to mention, which is a little bit different than the others, it's called The Climate Crisis is a Health Crisis. And this is coming up at the University of Alberta on April 24th. It's part of their President Speaker Series. And I thought that was a pretty interesting angle to take on climate discussions. So I expect that'll be a pretty intriguing discussion.
Well, not only that discussion, but these discussions, Mac, they're very intriguing discussions that we have every week. And this is the end of that discussion. There will be no more discussion to be had this week, but we can do it again next week if you want. That's probably fine.
I think that works for me. Yeah.
Until then, I'm Troy.
I'm Mac.
And we're
Speaking Municipally.